This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Hip-hop is being celebrated this month in honor of its 50th anniversary. My guests are two music journalists who love hip-hop, cover it for NPR Music, have written extensively about it for most of their adult lives, and grew up with it. But they're also not afraid to call out hip-hop when they see misogyny, homophobia, or transphobia. Rodney Carmichael and Sidney Madden host the NPR hip-hop podcast Louder Than a Riot. Here's how they describe this season.
And from NPR Music, this is Louder Than a Riot.
Where we confront the double standard that's become the standard.
On every episode this season, we tackle one unwritten rule of hip-hop that affects the most marginalized among us and holds the entire culture back.
And one that a new generation of rap refuses to stand for.
This season, they're highlighting the stories of female, gay, and queer rappers who were daring enough to be themselves in spite of all the pressure to conform to the standards set by the straight, often hyper-masculine men who have dominated rap for most of its history. In the first season, Louder Than a Riot investigated the connection between hip-hop and mass incarceration, or as they put it, the collision of rhyme and punishment in America. Unfortunately, Louder Than a Riot was one of the shows NPR eliminated during its recent round of budget cuts, so the current second season is also the final one. Sidney Madden, Rodney Carmichael, welcome to Fresh Air. I've really enjoyed your podcast, and it's a pleasure to have you on the show. I'm sorry that the show was canceled, but at least you got two really good seasons out of it.
Oh, thanks so much, Terry. We're definitely glad to be here. Even knowing you've been listening, so that's great.
I know. We're definitely honored to be here, and we're proud of the two seasons that got us here. So thank you so much.
What's the hip-hop track that first got you really excited about hip-hop?
Oh, man.
Oh, wow.
I have a standard answer to that. It's a track that's still probably celebrated today. You probably heard it a lot this month if you were tuned in to hip-hop 50 celebrations. It's not the first hip-hop song I ever heard. But it's the first song that showed me that hip-hop, you know, could be more than just partying, for instance, mm-hmm. you know. And it's the song by Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five, The Message.
I love this track so much. It's so well written. And, of course, Melly Mel is doing the rapping, but Duke Booty actually wrote the lyrics.
Duke Booty, that's right.
And it's so good because it shows everything that's going on outside. That's making the rapper wonder how he keeps from going under. And it shows both, like, anger, social commentary, and vulnerability at the same time.
Exactly.
Because, you know, he's trying to prevent himself from going under and saying, like, don't push me because I'm close to the edge. So it's just so well done, and the rapping is so good on it.
And you know, Terry, if I can say, like, that's still my favorite kind of rap song. Like, that's a whole lane of rap that, you know, continues. Like, if you look at trap music is very much that lane. Quote unquote gangster rap in the 90s was very much that lane. You know, all of my favorite rappers, a lot of them talked about struggle and overcoming mm-hmm. and, you know,
tension.
Insurmountable mm-hmm. odds. All of that stuff, you know, that's hip hop at its finest, you know.
Yeah. I'm really glad you chose this. Let's hear a little bit of it.
It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. Glass everywhere, people pissing on the stage, you know they just don't care. I can't take the smell, can't take the noise, got no money to move out, I guess I got no choice. Rats in the front room, roaches in the back, junkies in the alley with the baseball bat. I tried to get away, but I couldn't get far, cause a man with a tow truck repossessed my car. Don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. Standing on the front stoop, hanging out the window, watching all.
And Sidney, is there a track for you that you listened to early on that really kind of made you fall in love with the music? And I realize you're younger than Rodney, so you were kind of surrounded by it, and yeah. that's all you... Probably the first music you heard.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, just something that was really formative for you.
I do vividly remember going to the supermarket and being allowed to buy the Miseducation of Lauryn Hill CD with my allowance and playing it back to back over and over, but, you know, stopping on certain songs. And I feel like Lost Ones was really one of those songs for me. It just talked about, similar to Rodney, the tension, the fleeting nihilism, the diary aspect to it, and really just putting to words so much of the swirling emotions I felt coming up, but never knew how to describe or never had the vocabulary of for myself.
All right, let's hear it.
It's funny how money changes situation. Miscommunication lead to complication. My emancipation don't fit your equation. I was on the humble, you on every station. Someone play young Lauryn like she done. But remember not to game the one of the sun. Everything you did has already been done. I know all the tricks from bricks to Kingston. My ting done, major kingdom, one run. Now understand El Boogie, not violent. But if a thing test me, run for me gun. Can't take a threat to me newborn son. El been this way since creation. A groupie call you far from temptation. Now you on ball over separation. Tarnish my image in the conversation. Who you gonna scrimmage like you the champion? You might win some, but you just lost one. You might win some, but you just lost one. You might win some, but you just lost one. You might win some, but you just
okay,
lost
so
one.
That was the track chosen by Sidney Madden as one of the formative tracks that she loved in hip-hop. So why did you decide to do a season critical of hypermasculinity and misogyny in hip-hop?
Well, coming off the first season where, as you said, Terry, it was all about the collision of rhyme and punishment in America, we still wanted to examine that unique and complicated relationship. And so what we did is we shifted our lens to look inward at hip-hop on the eve of what would be its 50th birthday and reconcile some of the inequalities that hip-hop has not pushed against but actually embodied in becoming this behemoth of industry and culture. And where we're at right now with who's running hip-hop, where the barometer is at with hip-hop, we talk about it a little bit in the second season, like the girls and the gays are running things. Like they are the culture crusaders at this point. When you think about who is creating trends, who's starting talking points, who's ending and deading old tropes and old archetypes. And we wanted to spotlight not only those people, but kind of examine everything that has come before that they need to be pushing against in the first place.
Rodney, were you reluctant at all to take on this theme or these themes during the season, thinking you'd get a lot of pushback from hip-hop fans for criticizing aspects of hip-hop?
Definitely not. I think that Sidney and I were very much on the same page about season two and the theme. And, you know, both season one and season two were very much about us taking the temperature of the culture in that moment. And when we looked around and saw what was happening and what was going on within hip hop at that time, it was like, you know, the story, subject, and theme for this season was basically being served to us. So it was well past due, but also right on time, you know. And I'm speaking specifically about Megan Thee Stallion and Tory Lanez. That case, you know, interestingly enough, just been resolved in the last few weeks. Tory Lanez got sentenced to 10 years. Now, when we were conceptualizing this season, the trial hadn't even started yet, you know. But the culture, hip-hop culture specifically, was reacting really strongly to what happened. And Megan Thee Stallion, honestly, was just taking a lot of flack, a lot of heat. And I mean, a lot of the themes that we cover in this season were happening in real time, you know. And in the case, for people that aren't familiar, was a case of Tory Lanez shooting Megan Thee Stallion after they had been at a house party in the Hollywood Hills one night.
And she didn't come forward immediately, and when she did, a lot of people didn't believe her. And
exactly.
There were even stories that, oh, she shot herself.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was wild.
Yeah, but finally it came to trial, and he was sentenced. I want to talk with you about one of the first women who in hip-hop who you devote an episode to early in the season, and that's Sha-Rock. And she was in the group The Funky Four Plus One. She was the plus one. And they're really early in the history of rap. Their first recording is 1980 on Sugar Hill Records. Sugar Hill was like the first hip-hop label. And before we talk about what happened to her, let's hear some music. So this is That's the Joint, and we'll pick up on the part where she's rapping.
She's the joint!
Get up, y'all. Do it up. Sha-Rock is gonna show you how you get real rough. I'm Sha-Rock, and I can't be stopped. For all the fly guys, I will hit the top. Well, I can do it for the ones go weak and strong, and I can do it for the ones that are right or wrong. Well, I'm listed in the column that's classified. I can be a nurse, and I'm qualified to talk about respect. I won't neglect. My strategy is for you to see, so don't turn away by what I say, cause I'm bad when I'm talking to you. Therefore, fly brothers who could do it too. The party people in the place is just for you, so get down, get on down. I'm the plus one more, and I'm throwing down.
She's the best female in this here town,
and everybody know that I'm Goldie Brown, and you know
she's a joint.
I'm a pulling young lady with nice fine styles.
So that was the Funky Four Plus One, with Sha-Rock being the plus one. So they're the first group, the first hip-hop group on Saturday Night Live. She's the first, I think she's the first, like, recorded hip-hop female. Why was she basically shut out?
Well, one of the big things that ends up happening to Sha-Rock that just kind of shows how different the times are now versus then is really at the height of the Funky Four's success, Sha-Rock gets pregnant, and the height of success for them is being the first hip hop group to appear on Saturday Night Live. You know, they have this really big performance. A lot of their peers at the time are upset because they feel like they should have been the group that was chosen to, you know, do this big thing, bring hip hop to the masses on Saturday Night Live. The Funky Four was picked specifically because Sha-Rock was in the group. You know, this was the night that Debbie Harry was hosting the show, and she was familiar with the Funky Four and really liked them because they were young and fresh, and they had Sha-Rock, you know, and she wanted to spotlight them. And Sha-Rock is pregnant at the time of the performance, which a lot of people in hip-hop, you know, don't find out till years later. I mean, we talked to DMC of Run DMC for this episode. He's a huge fan of Sha-Rock. He didn't know until we told him during the interview that Sha-Rock was pregnant at that time. You know, so she was hiding it at the time because she felt like it would in some way, shape, or form be construed as detrimental to their success and everything they were doing. And when she told them after the show, that's what happened. You know, her group members did not support her, did not hold her down. And, you know, the sentiment pretty much was, man, you know, we're on the cusp here and you're messing this up right now. So there were lots of factors that went into the group splitting up. But her treatment by her group members, by hip hop culture at that time, was really a huge part of what ended up happening and why her name, you know, has not rang out in the way that it should have based on her being this pioneering, you know, first woman MC.
And compare that to how pregnancy is treated now. I mean,
exactly.
Hip hop artists like show off their baby bump. It's a big thing that they're really proud of that they show in various ways.
It's the thing now. It's not taboo anymore. Yeah.
No, which is great. One of the stories that you did was about how the Me Too movement basically passed by hip hop. And to illustrate that, you tell the story of Kim Osorio, who was like the first female editor in chief of The Source, which was for a time, the Bible of the hip-hop movement. They sponsored their own awards, which were very important awards in the world of hip-hop, and she came forward and accused the magazine's owners of harassing her and discriminating against her because of her gender. And she sued the magazine and her former bosses for gender discrimination, sexual harassment, hostile work environment, retaliation, and defamation. But in 2006, when it came to trial, the claims of hostile environment or being a victim of sexual harassment and gender discrimination were dismissed. But the owners were found guilty of defaming her in interviews after they fired her, and they were convicted of firing her in retaliation. So what are your thoughts on the Me Too movement having passed by hip-hop? First of all, what do you mean by that?
Well, it was really important for us to investigate and revisit this case because when it was actually going down in the early 2000s, the big headline news from this case was more so that Kim Osorio herself, as the former editor-in-chief, was getting a little too close and personal with rappers. So it was kind of residually defaming her in the midst of her claiming that this place that she worked, that was considered the hip-hop Bible at the time, was an unsafe place for women. And when we say it kind of the Me Too movement missed hip-hop, this is a case that really predates the Me Too movement if we're thinking about the social shift that happened with the quote-unquote Me Too movement in 2015. And it could have been a moment that actually theoretically started off the Me Too movement, knowing how influential hip-hop was in the early 2000s and the reason she was not successful on the claims of workplace harassment was around the severe and pervasive standard that was just recently done away with in the state of New York. And she presented, her and her lawyers presented all these examples of unsavory, disgusting, icky types of moments and events that happen in the workplace. But overall,
what are we talking about? Yeah.
We're talking about pornography being hung up on the walls. We're talking about men's only meetings where women were not allowed, you know, like one of the former owners of the magazine would go around and touch female staffers very inappropriately, touch bra straps, gift people Victoria's Secret underwear for holiday parties. And Osorio even claims that one of the owners kind of cornered her in an elevator one night and said, "We could be the king and the queen of the source. Come on, what are you doing?" And really pressed her on that. And the other owner, he was aware of all these behaviors and this culture that was being set and being allowed to rock in the magazine, in the office, and he didn't really do anything to stop it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So after the trial, once we get to the Me Too movement years mm-hmm. later, do you think the Me Too movement had an impact on hip-hop culture and on women's ability to speak up?
I don't think it did, and I don't think it really has. I mean, there've been many examples in the hip hop space and in the hip hop music space and the hip hop culture space where women have come forward, people have come forward, and it hasn't really made a seismic shift in how Black women and people presenting as Black women or anybody else who is not in the majority, who is not a cishet Black man, is treated in these spaces. There's examples of people like Drew Dixon, who told her entire story of harassment and abuse at the hands of Russell Simmons, and other women have come out and speaking out against Russell Simmons, and it hasn't made any seismic type of shift. And it's not a one-to-one comparison. It's not a workplace it's not workplace violence, but it is a comparable example to look at how Megan Thee Stallion was disbelieved by a lot of heavy hitters in hip hop, was ridiculed, was made fun of, was residually harassed for years later, even after being shot at by someone who she thought was her friend, another person in the hip hop world. And it just goes to show you that even with the pendulum swings of influence and and like cash flow, fluidity, and just popularity of Black women, Black femmes, and anyone else, anyone trans in this space who's making waves culturally, the idea that they are still not believed and respected is very much present.
So I want to talk with you about your own lives in hip hop and how the music influenced you. Rodney, you have a whole episode about how you were influenced by the hyper-masculinity and misogyny in an era of hip hop when you were growing up. What was the image of masculinity you got from the music that you most loved?
Well, you know, in a lot of ways, it was nuanced, especially in the beginning. I'm talking mid-80s on up, from Big Daddy Kane and Rakim to Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince, who were definitely an early favorite of mine. You know, for every LL Cool J you had, you know, there was an MC Hammer, you know, which, though he got a lot of flack at the time for his pop leanings, he liked to dance. And, you know, I was growing up in Atlanta, and dance was very much a part of our hip-hop culture down here. So, I mean, if you were a young Black man growing up in the 90s and you were receiving these messages of Black men being an endangered species and this war on drugs, which we now understand was really a war on Black people, the mass incarceration era is kind of getting ramped up. And there was an intensity, you know, the crack era, there was an intensity around how you present yourself as a man. And the music was reflecting that as well, you know. And a lot of my favorite rappers were hyper masculine. And it was something that I fed off of because in a lot of ways it felt like it was something that I needed to be as well.
What, what's the image of hyper-masculinity that you're describing? What goes along with
that? I mean, N.W.A. comes to mind. Luke and early 2 Live Crew come to mind. You know, there was hyper-sexual music. N.W.A., obviously, they pretty much pioneer what becomes known as gangster rap to some or reality rap to others, but very much street and...
Two Live Crew, who you mentioned, they have a song that's basically about gang rape, kind of glorifying it.
Yeah. They had a song that I can't say the title of on air. But in a lot of ways, I think it does kind of introduce you, depending on your age at the time. I was really young when this came out. It kind of introduces you to rape culture. You know what I mean? And I guess maybe not introduces, but it makes it very casual in terms of how you think about sex, especially if you haven't had it yet, you know, and everything that you're consuming at that point in time is kind of teaching you and schooling you. And, you know, even if you had great parents at home, it's really hard to not be swayed by what you're internalizing your culture, you're internalizing the music. And, you know, that was definitely one of the things that I was hearing.
How did it actually shape your behavior? Or did it shape your behavior? You know, listening to lyrics by hyper-masculine rappers, you know, or people posing as hyper-masculine and rapping about guns and drugs and women and sex. And so did that shape your behavior as well as just, you know, fantasies and, you know, having those lyrics live in your head?
I mean, I think it made me check my sensitivity, which is probably the first thing that happens, right? You just start to learn how to guard or hold up a guard or mask your own sensitivity
and vulnerability. Out in the world.
And vulnerability, yeah. Especially, well, both really with other men, but most definitely with women as well. You know, women that you're interested in, women that you might have tender feelings for, but, you know, you might feel like it's not necessarily cool to express that too much, you know, or be too open or vulnerable about that. You know, you learn how to pose and mask a little bit, or at least you try to.
Cindy, what about you? You grew up with a lot of the same music. How did it affect your idea of what it meant to be female?
Yeah, there were messages of overt objectification, but there were also messages of being the weirdo and being successful at it. So I'm thinking, like, you know, yeah, I grew up on Trina, but I also grew up on Lauryn Hill, and I also grew up on Missy Elliott, which if you say those three names, you could think of, like, completely divergent messages and divergent paths of what those women represent in hip-hop. But to me, it was like I was on shuffle and I was listening to all those messages at the same time. So it's hard to say that I had one succinct and loud message about what being a Black woman was courtesy of hip-hop, because I had all this variety and all this dexterity.
Well, you had women rappers. Women were coming forward. Women were popular. So, Rodney, you talk in your very personal episode about how being a father made you hear hip-hop differently. You wanted your son to love it like you did, but you didn't want the songs to form his image of what it meant to be a man. And when he was 3 years old, you played him a Biggie track. And so the track that you mentioned that you played him in the episode is Everyday Struggle. So I want to play just a little bit of that. And
okay.
Wow. So we're gonna play the beginning. So we'll hear the chorus.
I hear death knocking at my front door. I'm living every day like a hustle. Another drug and juggle. Another day, another struggle. I don't wanna live no more. Sometimes I hear death knocking at my front door. I'm living every day like a hustle. Another drug and juggle. Another day, another struggle. I know how it feel to wake up messed up. Pockets broke as hell. Another rock to sell. People look at you like you's the user, selling drugs to all the losers, mad Buddha abuser. But they don't know about your stress-filled day. Baby on the way, mad bills to pay. That's right. Why you drink Tangeray, so you can reminisce and wish you wasn't living so devilish.
So that is, in fact, a really catchy Biggie track. Why did you want to choose that track to play for your son? Because, you know, in addition to the fact that the track has a lot to do with, like, dealing drugs and having guns and stuff, it's like in part about death, you know, sometimes feeling like death is knocking at your door, which is a complicated concept for a 3-year-old who probably doesn't know what death is yet. So can you talk about the experience of playing that for your son and what you wished for and what you didn't wish for when you played it?
Well, it started out much more innocently than that. My wife bought him a Biggie t-shirt, you know, which is it's a picture of his first album cover, Biggie's, you know, debut album cover, which, for anybody familiar knows, it's a picture of a baby. It's supposed to be a likeness of Biggie. It's a baby with an afro and a diaper, you know, Ready to Die is the album title. And I couldn't have my son walking around representing Biggie in this t-shirt without having any clue or idea what he was wearing. So I started playing him Juicy, which is the big commercial single off of that album. Very different kind of song. It's, you know, it's Biggie kind of projecting himself into success, which obviously he ended up attaining before he died. And, you know, it's that kind of rapper's fantasy of, you know, I'm a millionaire and I made it and I moved my family out of the projects, et cetera, gloss and glamour. But right after Biggie, the next song in the track list is Everyday Struggle. I don't know, there's something about the sample, you know, it's very catchy. You hear the melody playing, and yeah, he just grew to like it. Obviously, he doesn't know what it's about, although he always asks me what it's about.
Yeah, it's so funny to think of a three-year-old wanting to sing, I don't want to live no more. Sometimes I hear death knocking at my door. That's a lot.
he doesn't know the lyrics. He does not sing along.
Right.
But I think part of that is why I wanted to do an episode like this, because I know that I want to be armed with the conversations to be able to have with him about how to, you know, process and ingest and still have a respect for and enjoy this culture, you know, and this music that I love, you know. And a lot of these topics are very adult topics, but, you know, I think that it's better to start as a father thinking about that earlier than later, You know, I mean, hip hop has given me a lot of things. Like Sydney was saying, the gangster thing was one element, but it also gave me a love for being weird and being open. And, you know, De La Soul and A Tribe Called Quest and groups like that were my favorite, too. And I want him to develop a relationship with the range of that experience as well, because it's the range of black folks' experience in this country.
You know, in talking about raising a son and wanting him to love hip hop as much as you do, but wanting him to, you know, think about the lyrics and all of that, you talk about how, you know, hip hop heads obsess over their daughters and protecting their daughters. And you say when right. it comes to baby girls, the patriarchy don't play. But meanwhile, the same people raise their sons to, you know, be as bad as old dad, is what you say. So can you talk about trying to grapple with that as a father? You know,
yeah, that double standard, man. That's what the season is about. I mean, so my son is four now, and that's still his favorite song. I'm really trying to expose him to more rap. He wants to hear B.I.G. every day. It's like, what have I created? But my wife and I had a daughter last year, and yeah, it was during the time of making this episode and this season, and so it was impossible to not think about the way that fathers. You know, even hip-hop fathers, there's so many songs I could think about where, you know, we're being doting dads when we think about daughter and wanting to protect them from this and wanting to make sure we don't expose them to that. And really, in a lot of ways, a lot of the things that we're doing with our sons is replicating and is going to continue to replicate the mistreatment and marginalization of women and other folks, queer folks especially. So I really felt like in terms of thinking about what can my contribution to this be as, you know, a guy in hip hop for a long time. I've been a hip hop writer for a long time. I'm the co-host of this podcast. The answer to me was pretty plain. It was like thinking about what it is that I'm giving and gifting to the next generation. You know, and I think the best way to do that is by focusing more on my son and making sure that I don't, you know, replicate all of the kind of built-in misogyny and sexism that kind of comes with the culture and with, you know, culture at large, because it's not just hip hop, obviously, like you said earlier.
No,
you know,
most certainly not.
Yeah. So that was kind of the inspiration for that episode, for sure.
I'd like to end by asking you to choose a current or recent recording that you love, a hip-hop recording that you love, that makes you really excited about the present and future of hip-hop. Sydney, you want to start?
Yes. Okay. So as we said earlier, the girlies are really running things in rap right now, the precursors to everything influential, everything popping. And one of my favorite tracks that's come out in the last year, I think it actually came out last fall, is Tomorrow 2, which is by the Memphis rapper Glorilla with a feature from Cardi B. So first of all, Cardi B has been on a legendary feature run right now in the last few years. And this Memphis and Bronx mashup is just such a great calling card for cross-cultural collaborations and showing where it can be catapulted to. It works so beautifully. The beat is sparse. It has just this like sinister piano to it. It's quotable. It's aspirational. And it's a whole mantra. I mean, like, I don't care about my credit score. I could be up tomorrow, okay? I don't care what you say about me today. The sun is going to shine tomorrow. I'm good, you know? It's one of those songs that you cannot be mad at after listening to. And it's heavy in my rotation, and it will be forever.
All right, let's hear it.
I can't love you, baby, like your dude, so don't leave her. Keep that. He going to choose her every time because it's cheaper to keep her. Can't say your name up in my songs. Might not with you tomorrow. Can't get my feelings hurt today. I won't give a tomorrow. If the buy no credits go, I might be rich. Every day the sun won't shine, but that's why I love the Mars.
Riding with my twin and them, and we all look good as gang. She said she my eye, but I don't know her. I had to look her up. I know that I'm rich, but I can help it. I'm hood as fuck. I've been on these necks so long, sometimes I fucking stuck. I can put you in my business. You might wish me dead tomorrow. Be on today, sing every word of up tomorrow. I still got cases open. Keep your mouth shut tomorrow. Play with me today, then get some sleep. You know it's up tomorrow. Woo!
Okay, so that was Sydney Madden's pick for a song that's making her excited about the present and future of hip-hop. Rodney Carmichael, your turn. Can you choose something for us?
Yeah, so I'm going to pick a song from an album that dropped earlier in August. It's by the artist No Name, and the name of the song is Namesake. And I like this song because she is calling out everybody, including herself, in terms of how they, you know, are active participants in capitalism. And when I say everybody, I'm talking about some of the top names in the business, you know, from Jay-Z and Beyonce and Rihanna, Kendrick Lamar. And like I said, she name checks herself, too, for performing at Coachella. But the thing about this song that I really like is it shows that hip hop can still be a countercultural force, you know, because it takes a lot to be an artist of No Name's caliber and to go against some of the biggest names in the industry and really going against the industry and calling the industry out while you're in the industry. You know, that's a hard challenge. And it really, to me, it resonates with a lot of the spirit of what hip hop was in its infancy when it really felt like this revolutionary art form.
Well, let's go out with that. So before we do, I want to thank you both. Rodney Carmichael, Sydney Madden, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for the podcast, Louder Than a Riot.
Thank you, Terry.
Thanks so much, Terry. We really appreciate it.
So Rodney Carmichael and Sydney Madden host the NPR Hip Hop podcast, Louder Than a Riot. And here's No Name.
Yo, I never need no man. I got a little bit of love and a couple of friends. Picture me rolling up the bud in the South Sudan. Yo, I never need no. Yo, I never need no man. I got a little bit of love and a couple of friends. Picture me rolling up the bud in the South Sudan. Yo, I never need no name. Where's you came? We can stand in the rain, maintain a good life. We can fight, plantain. Same day, the airstrike, strike down our rain. I ran into the house with a blunt in my hand. Let's smoke. I don't want to see death no more. Let's fight. They got the devil hiding in plain sight. That's you. That's me. The whole world is culpable. Why complacency float the boat the most? I don't really get it. Y'all ain't really with it. All they eat the rich.
That's Namesake from No Name's new album, Sundial. Rodney Carmichael and Sydney Madden host the NPR hip-hop podcast, Louder Than a Riot. We have more hip-hop interviews coming up before this 50th anniversary month ends. This Wednesday, we plan to feature an interview with Justin Tinsley, author of a new book about Biggie Smalls. Next Monday, through Labor Day, we're doing a History of Hip-Hop series featuring interviews from our archive with several foundational hip-hop artists, including Grandmaster Flash, Melly Mel, Ice-T, Daryl McDaniels of Run-DMC, Queen Latifah, De La Soul, The Beastie Boys, Andre 3000, Questlove, Jay-Z, and more. This is Fresh Air.